2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 323, Two Naturalistic Theories of the Creation of the Book of Ether, a paper presented by Robert D. Anderson, with a response by Alan Roberts.
My presentation will take about 28 minutes, and then we'll open for any kind of discussion, challenges, questions that you want. It is a provocative paper, and I'm going to begin with a provocative statement having to do with the assumptions behind the paper. The title of the paper is Two Naturalistic Theories Concerning the Creation of the Book of Ether and the Book of Mormon. Assumptions of this paper. The naturalistic scientific evidence concerning the story in the Book of Mormon is now overwhelming and consistent. There is no evidence from a consensus of scientists studying pre-Columbian America in the fields of archaeology, anthropology, ethnology, linguistics, and morphology that support the book. Recently, mitochondrial DNA and DNA studies have virtually eliminated the possibility that Native Americans have an ancestry from the Middle East. These studies have come from scientists with little or no interest in Mormonism. I consider these last studies from American research in DNA about as absolute as science can get. To be sure, there have been some critical attacks from anti-Mormons in the past. Of special note, Baptist minister M.T. Lamb demonstrated population implausibilities and travel impossibilities in the Book of Mormon. His work of 120 years ago probably led to the limited geographic theory that began in the 1950s. Further, Methodist minister Wesley Walters demonstrated Old Testament use in the Book of Mormon and investigated the styles of writing in the book that undermined its authenticity as scripture. These two studies do contain opinions and evaluations of the literary content of the book, a Book of Mormon that leaves them in the soft, quote-unquote, soft category of evidence. However, we are now at a position where we can expect all writings to be compatible with the hard evidence. Anyone who writes differently must begin by justifying his position and will be suspected of attempting to use science and history, and I'm going to quote from a researcher on the life of Jesus, only, quote, as far as it can go without impinging on the fundamentals of the creed or challenging the hegemony of the ecclesiastical bureaucracy. In such hands, orthodoxy is safe, but critical scholarship is at risk. Faith seems to make such writers immune to the facts. Such works are usually nothing more than historical ploy, and the church is filled with such writings. The totality of the historical and scientific literature is that the Book of Mormon is not a product of pre-Columbian America, but gives evidence, as one would therefore expect, of early 19th century American frontier. We then have reason to ask how the Book of Mormon was created. This paper will discuss two very different and incompatible theories concerning the creation of the Book of Ether and the Book of Mormon, but both are compatible with the hard evidence. First, the literary explanation. In 1832, Apostle Orson Hyde traveled to Connaught, Ohio to do missionary work. Those who listened to his presentation of the Book of Mormon said they had heard the story in names 20 years previously in a manuscript written by a former congregational minister who had now been dead for 16 years. Thus began the Solomon Spaulding theory of the origin of the Book of Mormon. The testimonies of eight responsible people were gathered by a disgruntled and irresponsible ex-Mormon by the name of D. Philastros Hubert, but their testimonies were also checked and confirmed by a responsible editor by the name of Howe, who, however, may have had the axe a grind inasmuch as his wife and daughter were early Mormon converts. These testimonies stated that Spaulding had written a number of manuscripts, including one story supposedly written by a Roman named Fabius, who, during the time of the Emperor Constantine, had had his ship swept off course between Rome and Britain by a storm and landed on the North American continent. This particular manuscript, entitled Manuscript Story, and I emphasize the word story in the title, Manuscript Story, was, 50 years later, rediscovered in Honolulu and has been published many times. This story has some similarities with the Book of Mormon, but the majority of both Mormons and non-Mormons who have read this manuscript and the Book of Mormon found the similarities too few and not convincing. But here are some of the most striking similarities. In his story, the author accidentally stumbles across a flat stone with some inscriptions. With a lever, he raised it up and found an artificial cave. He descended, found another large stone in the position of a door, and inside an earthen box with 8 sheets of parchment. When translated from the Latin, it told of Fabius and his shipmates and their interactions with the ancient Indians in the Great Lakes and Mississippi regions. The story is therefore of an ocean voyage from the old world to the new with a storm. There is one character, Hennick by name, that had a stone transparent to him. He could see through it, but it was opaque to others. And this stone, he could see things present and yet to come, including secrets of foreign courts and hidden treasures. From this point on, however, similarities with the Book of Mormon story require an increasing use of imagination. Believers in this theory do instead find many similarities between Book of Mormon stories and incidents from Old World authors, including Josephus, Bede, Geoffrey of Monmouth, Augustine, Livy Caesar, Plutarch, Herodotus, Virgil, and the Irish and Jewish myths. Thus, they suggest the author could not have been the semi-literate Joseph Smith. In contrast, Solomon Spalding had the education background and savvy for the stories in the Book of Mormon. But in their original memories, these friends of Spalding stated that he had taken this manuscript story, and gone back further in time and rewritten it in a larger version. This version, adherents believe, contains such names as Laban, Nephi, Lehi, Mormon, Moroni, Lamanites, and Nephites, was written in a biblical style and had the frequent phrase, quote, and it came to pass, unquote. This supposed story made the Indians descendants of Jews or of the lost 10 tribes, strong adherents believed and believe. Adherents believe this was the origin for the Book of Mormon and contained a great deal of religion in the story, class warfare, and destruction of the white section of the civilization. This larger version, entitled Manuscript Found, and I emphasize the word found, has never been refound if it ever existed. The witnesses stated that the manuscript story, the original one that has been found, bore no resemblance or very little resemblance to this manuscript found manuscript. Believers in the story believe that Hurlbut once had this manuscript found, but that it was displaced, destroyed, or sold to Joseph Smith. Over the next 50 years, these original testimonies were embellished and others added to the supposed history of this manuscript found. Some of these testimonies were implausible and a few impossible. For example, in 1833, Solomon Spalding's widow had, quote, no distinct knowledge, unquote, of the manuscript, thought her husband took it to the printing office, and was quite uncertain if it had been returned. 5 years later, she altered her story, saying that the manuscript had been written in the most ancient style, imitating the Old Testament, and she had carefully preserved it following her husband's death. Believing Mormons have sometimes ridiculed this story in the so-called memories of happenings 20 to 75 years previous. Mormons, perhaps intentionally as propaganda ploy, frequently confuse the refound manuscript story with the never-found supposed manuscript found, or seen them as one and the same, or ignored the belief of the Spalding adherents that there was a second or even more manuscripts that created the Book of Mormon. Devout Mormons further pointed out the implausibility of getting this never-found manuscript into a printing house in Pittsburgh, there discovered by Sidney Rigdon, and from there in one or more visits to an unknown youth living 250 miles to the northeast named Joseph Smith, Jr. Remember, this was a day when information, even among newspapers, traveled by horse and wagon at a rate of 4 miles an hour. With each step, the story becomes more difficult. However, careful scrutiny by Spalding believers have demonstrated the possibility of all these connections. Finally, the major objection by Mormon devotees is that this manuscript found has never been refound, if it ever originally existed. Show us the so-called second manuscript, Mormons demand, and then we'll take this theory seriously. To which antagonists to the Book of Mormon replied, no, you first show us the gold plates. Then we can compare those writings with the Book of Mormon. This theory deserves more consideration than ridicule, but even if dealt with seriously, it ends up a stalemate. It remains an improbable theory which requires supposition and gap-filling at every step of the way. Without someone finding the lost manuscript found, the theory cannot be proved or disproved. Enter William H. Whitson, Doctor of Divinity, Doctor of Laws, and head of the Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and a man, I might add, for whom I had very high regard. Beginning in the 1880s, he wrote a giant tome on the Spalding origin of the Book of Mormon. His tome has never been published, but it is available in typeset. Whitsett believed that Spalding had written the refound manuscript story, the one we have, as a scratchy, rough draft of his beginning imaginary ideas. Then he rewrote and enlarged this manuscript story, and it became Manuscript Found, which he believed was the basis for the Book of Ether. And that takes up about 6% of the whole Book of Mormon. From here, Whitsett believed, Spalding enlarged the story one more time, creating the majority of the Book of Mormon with the Nephite Lamanite emphasis. Whitsett emphasizes that the Mormon claim that the manuscript story, that original scratchy one, bears no connection with the Book of Mormon and has no meaning because it was only a preliminary scratch work. Whitsett believed that Rigdon later inserted the religious doctrines of the Disciples of Christ into the Spalding manuscript. These modifications took some years. Whitsett believed that Sidney Rigdon then met Joseph Smith on the 21st and 22nd of September 1823, and yearly thereafter. These visits, Joseph Smith would later describe as with the angel Moroni, or as originally written, Nephi. Whitsett also believed that the claimed visit with John the Baptist on the 15th of May 1829 was a visit with Rigdon, as was a stagecoach ride and long walk, 20 miles, during the night with a stranger when Joseph Smith traveled from Harmony, Pennsylvania to Palmyra after Martin Harris had lost the 116 pages. Whitsett is thus proposing an enlarging literary progression with similarities between the manuscript story, the scratchy rough draft, and the imagined manuscript found that has never been refound if it ever existed, and between this manuscript found and the Book of Ether, and finally acknowledges the obvious similarities between the Book of Ether and the total Book of Mormon. As I mentioned, the Spalding manuscript does have a few similarities with the Book of Mormon story, but what I want to focus on is Whitsett's belief that the never-found, imagined, manuscript-found manuscript is the literary source for the Book of Ether, and thus a mid-step for the whole Book of Mormon. Consider these similarities. And how long has it been since you read the Book of Ether? Okay. Between the Jaredite story and the Nephite version. Both stories were written by the final major prophet of civilization that traveled from the Middle East to the New World. Both beginning prophets, that is, the brother of Jared and Nephi, are described with similar features. Both groups wander in the wilderness for years before their sea journey, and both families consisted of a father with four sons. In both the Jaredite and the Nephite stories, the journey is very similar. both tell of ocean voyages from the Old World to the New and include storms at sea. Both come from gold plates. Both records were found and translated by divine action. That is the accidental discovery of the 24 gold plates by Ammon's search party, and later translated miraculously by King Benjamin in the Book of Mormon, and in parallel the angelic discovery of the gold plates in the ground and translated miraculously by Joseph Smith. And while there are inconsistencies in the story, the claim is that both stories may have been translated using the same seer stones 2,000 years apart. These seer stones are central to both stories, for in the Nephite Lamanite version, they are supplied to Joseph Smith by a former Nephite, that is Moroni, and in the other, the seer stones are created by the premortal Jesus. Both peoples divide into two genocidal factors, and at the end, both groups are filled with hate and equally unrepentant. Both stories contain common motifs: a famine, a secret criminal society, assassinations, knifings, intrigues, and wars. The evil Nephite king Noah and the evil Jaredite king Replakish share 12 similarities in their personalities. Both civilizations end in a gigantic battle at the Hill Cumorah, previously called Ramah. Both books are named after the final major prophet in each of the two books. It is understandable why Whitsitt would consider the smaller book of Ether as a prodrome to the larger Nephite story. He bases this belief, I think, on the common experience of writers in expanding a short story into a larger, more complex one. Examples are found everywhere in literature. It is possible that Whitsitt's manuscript was never published because of the rediscovery of the manuscript story, manuscript, and successful propaganda by the Mormon Church around 1885 after the manuscript story manuscript had been found. He gave the manuscript to the Library of Congress in 1885. There's little psychology in it. Freud's initial work, The Interpretation of Dreams, was published 15 years later and opened the door to investigation of our internal worlds. That ends the section having to do with the literary theory concerning the origin of the Book of Mormon. I now move into one I'm going to suggest, the psychological explanation. I have proposed a different theory for the existence of the Book of Ether, and in summary, that it is a summary statement of the Book of Mormon combined with the six-year period of Joseph Smith's life between 1823 and 1829. In this view, it is the larger Nephite portion of the Book of Mormon that is the mid-step. The first step is Joseph Smith's life. What I am proposing is that the first larger Nephite part of the Book of Mormon is a disguised autobiography of Joseph Smith up to the time he starts the dictation. The simplest example is the first story of Nephi and Laban in the trip to the New World. Nephi was the fourth child of a father with supernatural abilities and whose dreams were considered visions. Nephi is becoming a great prophet, even superseding his father. Similarly, Joseph Smith was the fourth child of a man who claimed supernatural abilities and whose dreams the family considered visions, and Joseph Smith superseded his father as a visionary. The Book of Mormon family of Lehi made multiple small moves to and around the Red Sea, extending over 8 years, then one gigantic move to the New World. Similarly, the Smith family moved over 10 times in a 16-year period, with one major move from New England to Palmyra, but of course on a wagon, not a ship. What becomes increasingly important is not just the similarities between these parallel stories, but the specific way in which Joseph Smith alters his life history into the Book of Mormon fantasy. The first story will again demonstrate. When Joseph Smith was somewhere between 5 and 7, he was a helpless child experiencing an overwhelming painful illness and then an excruciating leg surgery. Elements in that surgery were sharp cutting instruments and wine. If he is replaying that surgery in the story of Laban with his sword and his drunkenness by wine, he has done two things to the story. One, he has reversed his small helplessness into total control. And two, he then exaggerates the story from just imagination into miracle. These two psychological steps, I believe, unlock the explanation behind much of the creation of the Book of Mormon. Here's what I think happened. I think Joseph Smith dictated the stories in the Book of Mormon after practicing with his family in nightly meetings for 4 years, and of course his mother documents this. After the first 116 pages were destroyed, he continued to the end of the small Book of Mormon in the Book of Mormon, then returned and redid the last 116 pages. But by this time, he was aware that his claim of supernatural abilities as a translator was gathering a significant following, and a superficial alter ego, or false self, however you want to term it, was rapidly reaching final form. Who he would become had been crystallized in the 6 years between 1823 and 1829, at the time of his dictation. Now, instead of wandering in poverty and helplessness, as his father had done, and alcoholism, he now becomes a person of importance, and he has a clear identity. He now takes this period of his own life with claims of seer stones, visitation of an angel, and translation of a gold record, and he combines it with the Book of Mormon story he has just completed dictating, and once again expands this combination of book and life into increased greatness and exaggerated fantasy. Thus, the Book of Ether. Joseph Smith's original voyage from New England to Palmyra lasted perhaps 6 weeks, while he was still lame from the surgery and brutalized by other people. This story, in the Nephite version, was enlarged to the manufacture of a boat and a scary ocean voyage with Nephi in control through his miraculous powers over the Liahona. Now, in the Book of Ether, the voyage is expanded and exaggerated one more step into fantastic fantasy. It takes a year in 8 miraculous and impossible submarine-like vessels with no windows or doors. And so the rest of the Book of Ether. It is the Nephite story, highly condensed with exaggeration at every step of the way. It comes from a more ancient and fanciful time than the Nephite story and covers a longer period of time. The civilization is much larger. While 240,000 Nephite soldiers supposedly died at Cumorah, Orson Pratt estimated that over 2 million soldiers, along with wives and children, died in the final Jaredite conflagration. And in this surgery, in this theory, the surgery performed on little Joseph's leg became the story of Nephite's murder of Laban, and then became the more extreme battle to death between Coriantumr and Shiz. Everything in the story is more extreme than the Nephite story. The wars, miracles, evil intrigue, and ultimate destruction. And he mixes in his Book of Mormon dictation that he has just completed with his own recent fanciful story that has become real to him through the validation of belief of his family and followers. Focus for a moment on the original story of Joseph Smith beginning as a rodsman with a divining rod and then as a scryer with a stone in a hat. Expand this into an angel providing seer stones. Now he takes this fanciful story and recreates it into 2 seer stones provided miraculously, not just by an angel, but created in prehistorical time by the premortal Jesus. We now know that his later first vision story of God and Jesus had not yet been created. But consider this story progression from rodsman to scryer with a seer stone in a hat, then to an angel providing 2 seer stones, then to the visit of the premortal Jesus to the brother of Jared while creating the seer stones, all as a prodrome to his later further developed story of the visit of God and Jesus. So while Whitsitt believed the development of the Book of Mormon went from the refound preliminary manuscript story, which we do have, to the unfound manuscript found as the basis for the Book of Ether, and then finally to a third enlarged manuscript for the Nephite Lamanite story, I think it occurred in reverse order. A compensating fantasy for Joseph Smith's tragic and sad childhood, to the Nephite Lamanite story, and then exaggerated and condensed Book of Ether. My theory follows the scientific requirement of parsimony and explanation. Simplicity is what we're after. The very improbable complexities of the Spalding theory, which involve the added persons of Solomon Spalding and Sidney Rigdon, and then a Pittsburgh publishing house, repeated travels of round trips of 500 miles, and memories that are between 20 and 70 years old, are not necessary. All we need are parents and siblings who encourage fantasy of miracle and then treat it as fact. And then his own creativity, probably in part of the adult residual of a childhood post-traumatic stress disorder. His mental preoccupations demonstrated in the book were of terror, hatred, and destruction, and that's what the Book of Mormon is about. His creativity was later confirmed by his imaginary translation, for example, of Egyptian into the Book of Abraham. If one still insists he didn't have enough history to create the book, we do know he participated in a debating club in his mid-teens. He was a young exhorter at the religious meetings and also attended the revivals of 1824 and 25 when he was 19 years old, and the family read the weekly newspaper. Further, if we still need something more, all he had to do was read one book with 600 pages and 121 chapters of history, including 58 pages taken directly from Ethan Smith's A View of the Hebrews. This was Josiah Smith's book, The Wonders of Nature and Providence Displayed, compiled from ancient authentic sources, both ancient and modern, and many of the ideas in the Book of Mormon are found right in that book, including gigantic descriptions of gigantic explosions, volcanic earth eruptions, earthquakes, the darkness at the time of Jesus that was so thick it could be felt, and so on and so forth. And finally, after creating the Book of Ether, he dictates the final book in the Book of Mormon, the small book of Moroni. The reading of the first five short chapters containing rituals of ordination, the sacrament, discussion of baptism, and church behavior informs us that Joseph Smith had reached the point of planning to start a church. This ends my comparison of the two theories, and we're about to open for questions and comments, but there is a postscript which I want to add to all of this. These two theories are incompatible. As I mentioned, they are both compatible with the hard evidence, that is, that the Book of Mormon is a product of early 19th century America, but incompatible with each other. But there is a possible, not probable, connection between the two. Many, if not most, that believe the Book of Mormon is a product of 19th century America also credit Ethan Smith's A View of the Hebrews as a major source of the overarching concept of the book. We now know that Ethan Smith visited Palmyra, that 58 pages of the View of the Hebrews were in Priest's Wonder of Nature book, and that was 5 miles from Joseph Smith's home and repeatedly checked out, and that Oliver Cowdery's family were members of the congregation of Ethan Smith in Pulteney, Vermont. This latter fact had been known to the Pulteney Historical Society for some time, but the importance was not recognized. They happened to mention it to David Persuti, who informed the Methodist minister Wesley Walters, who in turn put it in his 1981 theological master's thesis. From there it entered general Mormon awareness. Persuti also added a new piece of information that possibly, but not probably, unites the two theories discussed above based on the speculation that Solomon Spalding and Ethan Smith were acquaintances. Both of these men were congregational ministers, and both did train at Dartmouth College. Spalding entered as a sophomore and graduated in 1785, but did not gain a license to preach until 1787, speculatively suggesting he stayed at Dartmouth until that date. Ethan Smith, the younger of the two, entered Dartmouth in 1786, so there is the possibility, speculative possibility, there was an overlap of 1 year between the two of them. A grandson of Ethan Smith told a reporter of the Cleveland Plain Dealer in a newspaper in 1887 that Solomon Spalding was a warm admirer of Dr. Smith and when a young man studied under his tuition. This doesn't make sense. This statement is in all probability a misunderstanding, and that the Dr. Smith referred to was Dr. John Smith, a professor at Dartmouth during the time both Ethan Smith and Solomon Spalding attended there. The possibility remains, however, that these two men were acquainted and Spalding may have written manuscripts that contained ideas from Ethan Smith, but again, that's all speculation. And I'm through with this presentation, but I'm after anything that I can get to encourage questions, challenges, and remarks.
Yes, he is.
A number of people mention him in their book almost incidentally. I really ran into him after my presentation here on my book a number of years ago when Mr. Byron Marchant here at Sunstone approached me and said he disagreed. He was a strong Spalding adherent and that he had Whitsitt's manuscript in typeset, and he supplied it to me for, I don't know, $15. But it's also in the Marriott Library special collections, and a number of other people have done it, and I have heard just recently there's a PhD thesis about Whitsitt. Let me make a further comment. I really admire this man. Let me make a comment about him. He trained under prestigious theologians in Europe, then came to the United States, where he taught polemical theology for a while, and then moved into the main Baptist Theological Seminary, moved to Kentucky. He became the head of it. He is known in Protestant circles for the Whitsitt controversy. He said that baptism by immersion had been lost in England but was restated in 1641. And this, what we would call the fundamentalist Baptists, could not tolerate this because they believed there had been a continuity of baptism by immersions by small groups from the time of Jesus all the way down through history in an unbroken consistency. It would be as if someone demonstrated that priesthood genealogy could not go back to the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon. There was a break in there somewhere. That would create the kind of storm in Mormonism that occurred at the Baptist Theological Seminary. The controversy raged for 4 years, and it got so bad that it looked like academic freedom was going to be lost. So Whitsitt retired, pulled back from it, rested a year, and then went to become head of the Department of Philosophy at Richmond College in Richmond, Virginia. So as a man who held to what he could do until, you know, he thought more destruction, and he refused to give up on that. W-H-I-T-S-I-T-T, William H. is the name. I better repeat here. I think you're first.
If the manuscript found is not available, how do we know what was in it?
It's all guess.
Like the names of Lehi, and that's very specific.
All they had, well, let's see, I better repeat the question. If we don't have the manuscript found, how do we know it was in it? The eight people in the book Mormonism Unveiled later would say that they had run across the names, they recognized the names, Lehi, Mormon, Moroni, Nephi, all these others in it. It is their collective memory that at that time and later they said was in this. So you have to challenge how much memory do you trust after 20 up to 70 years kind of thing. Okay.
Didn't Byron Martin connect Sidney Rigdon somehow with the Songs Falling and Equal Smith?
I don't. The question is, did Byron Martin connect Solomon Spalding and Cindy Rigdon? I don't know. I haven't heard of that. So, but the connection, of course, is the whole Spalding manuscript is believed to have come to, by these adherents, is believed to have come to Mormonism through Cindy Rigdon, who, Whitsitt is a strong proponent of this belief, believes Sidney Rigdon was a corrupt, deceitful man and got together with corrupt, deceitful Joseph Smith and combined this, putting into the Book of Mormon the doctrines and teachings of the newly formed Church of the Disciples of Christ. This is Whitsitt's main point, and he emphasizes that the Book of Mormon contains the Disciples of Christ theology. I suspect Whitsitt's book is the most comprehensive, largest evaluation of theology in the Book of Mormon by an outsider that's ever been done. Okay.
Following on that, I put it as succinctly as I can. I believe Whitsitt's main argument is that the best evidence for his argument is contained in the pages of the Book of Mormon, and that the theology developed among the Campbellites with Alexander Campbell, Walter Scott, and Sidney Rigdon is contained in those pages up to the point that Rigdon broke for the Campbellites, and that the issues that he broke on, such as the plan of salvation, which is there, but the restoration of the ancient order of things, but then he broke on the restoration of all things, and specifically miracles and gifts of the Spirit, laying on of hands. That theology also, after he broke the world, is also contained in the book. And I've yet to hear anyone anywhere respond to that argument.
What we've had has been a comment that is a very strong statement that the teachings in the Disciples of Christ are very strongly represented in the Book of Mormon. Maybe I can make a comment upon that if I can find the right footnote. And that specifically, Whitsitt believed that this was, let me read this. What we had just heard, having to do with the similarities between the teachings of the Disciples of Christ, as represented through Sidney Rigdon and the teachings in the Book of Mormon, is Whitsitt's main point. He concludes, the fact that all the peculiarities that distinguish the Disciples of Christ are all reproduced in the Book of Mormon is believed to be significant. Together, they constitute a cumulative argument which demonstrates that it is impossible the theological portion of the work could have been composed by any other than the hand of a disciple theologian. It would be difficult to discover anywhere a volume which reflects the teachings promulgated by the disciples between the years 1825 and 29 with better faithfulness and effect. In the warp and almost all the worth of the Book of Mormon, it is a disciple production. This single point is displayed by the emphasis that is laid upon gifts of the Spirit, such as speaking in tongues, the interpreting of tongues, healing of the sick and other miracles, continued inspiration and revelation, and the effective ministration of angels. Among all the various leaders of the disciples, there is none but Sidney who has been charged with a violent inclination in that direction. In a few words, the theological contents of the Book of Mormon are of such a complexion that no person in America, no other person in the world except Sidney Rigdon could or would have fashioned them.
Did you see the same pattern of the psychological progression in Joseph's later life?
Did I see the same progression pattern in Joseph Smith's later life? I haven't done a psychological study of his life after the production of the Book of Mormon. Except what he does, of course, in life is he reverses. He comes from poverty, helplessness, an alcoholic, unsuccessful background of poverty and moving. And he reverses that in becoming a heroic a giant prophet. So his whole life suggests a reversal of what he had been born as, from helplessness to really being in total control, which characterized the whole rest of his life.
What's the source of the alcoholic statement?
Any number. Let's see, Dan Vogel is here, and he might be able to summarize, but any number of people have commented upon, in early Mormonism, the alcoholic nature of the father and of Joseph Smith as well. And Dan, you want to make any comment on that? About alcohol, where's the original origin of the statement of alcoholism in the Smith family? And Jess Grossbeck also has commented upon that.
A lot of Palmyra residents speak of Joseph Smith Sr.'s drinking to the point of drunkenness, and probably the most telling source is Joseph Smith Sr.'s own admission in an 1834 blessing to his family that Hiram had stuck by him despite his being out of the way through wine. Now, if anybody knows about alcoholism, an alcoholic's the last person to ever admit that or recognize that they have a drinking problem. So for Joseph Smith Sr. to have made such a mission, it says quite a lot. anyway, that's one of the things. I take it very seriously when someone admits that they have a drinking, call it a drinking problem or alcoholism.
How about Joseph Smith?
Joseph Smith himself.
Joseph Smith Jr.? That was the inference.
No, he had mentioned Joseph Smith Sr. was the father. Well, he's still right. Joseph Smith Jr. Was also drunken quite a lot. And Martin Harris got himself into trouble once when he said before the High Council, he was brought before the High Council for saying that Joseph Smith drank too much while he was translating the Book of Mormon. And then he got in trouble, and so he kind of withdrew the statement and said that it all was prior to translating the Book of Mormon. But and I wanted to comment on Sidney Regan being the only one in the world that had a similar doctrines as the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith. There was a general movement since this. I spoke all about this in the book Religious Seekers and the Advent of Mormonism, about the primitive gospel movement, and that was a movement to get away from the doctrines of men that have been added to the gospel by the Catholic Church, and going back to the primitive gospel, then the primitive gospel movement had an argument among themselves about how much should you cut back, and how primitive should you get, and the Seekers were among the most radical. And they were seeking for a restoration of a priesthood authority, of angelic ordination, just like Joseph Smith fulfilled those expectations. Joseph Smith's uncle, Lucy Smith's brother, Jason Mack, was in this primitive gospel movement. He was a preacher, and he had a commune of several families, poor families that got together. So the whole principle of a economic community, united community, comes from Joseph Smith's own family. But Sidney Regan parted with Alexander Campbell on how much should be restored, and he went to a more radical extreme. But he wasn't the only one in the United States that wanted to go back and believe that you should restore apostles, restore the gifts, speak in tongues. So there's nothing that Sidney Regan did. It prepared the ground for the Mormon missionaries, but there were others scattered out throughout America and Europe that were what I term seekers, or had the seeker gospel, or an expectation that there would be a restoration. So I wouldn't be stuck that Joseph Smith was dependent on Sidney Regan at all. And when Joseph Smith, Sidney Regan was baptized, and Joseph Smith went there, by no means did Sidney Regan, control what the doctrine and what was being said there. So I totally discount the Spalding theory and the Sidney Regan connection altogether.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Dan. Next question here.
Do you plan to publish this or be submitted to the Sunstone or
Dialogue? Yes, I would like to. My position seems to be so extreme that I'm not so sure that even Sunstone wants to publish it. Yeah. Oh, anything really in Mormon literature that deals with William Whitsett. And he was, in my view, an outstanding man. His writings are erudite and at times absolutely delightful. You crack up just laughing at the brilliant scholarship with a quirkiness to it that is really fun to read. I'm sorry you asked the question. I have, first of all, the first half of the question, I have tried to evaluate what I think is the background of the psychology of Joseph Smith, which centers around what in psychiatry today is referred to as the narcissistic personality disorder. There have been questions, and I discussed the manic depressive question in an article in Dialogue that was published about 5 years ago. And because this was raised by Lawrence Foster after talking with Jess Grossup, and then the question is, did he have some kind of modern variation of manic depressive illness? And if he did, we've got to change all sorts of psychiatric descriptive rules. But I discussed that, tried to discuss it very thoroughly, and I can get that reference for you. I spend a number of pages going into that. But I not only label, and this is important, I not only label Joseph Smith as basic, having a narcissistic personality disorder with adult residual of post-traumatic stress disorder, but I also say, and it's painful to say this, that when you're talking about personality disorders, underlying personalities of people, they become complex and they mix with each other. And what I have done is mix Joseph Smith's with the antisocial personality. That has been done in the psychiatric literature, and especially by Otto Kernberg, who very clearly gives it a title called malignant narcissism, and is a mixture of a person who is very self-absorbed, is above everybody else, and very high, but he mixes it with psychopathic behavior. And I think that characterizes Joseph Smith. So now, concerning your last part of the question, what is it that draws people to Mormonism? And you're asking me for my opinion that becomes really very vague. But if you want, I'll move ahead on that. To make some general comments. First of all, I think Christianity has been in decline for about 900 years. We are nothing despite the fundamentalist movement, which frightens me, and the expansion of fundamentalist Mormonism, and I mean not just polygamous Mormon, but intense, overwhelming belief, frightens me as well. But we are nothing compared to the days of the beginning in Protestantism, or the hundreds of years before that, when Christianity ruled every moment of your life. With this decline in Christianity and the rise of our changing world, people are feeling very highly insecure. And what happened, Joseph Smith brought back evidence, the Book of Mormon, for the revitalization that Jesus really had lived and had been had died and resurrected and virgin birth and all this, which is what people were desperate for. I think he did one more thing, that people grab hold of Mormonism because in the original First Vision story, he presents the problem of Protestantism, which is the fracturing of the religion into different sects, contending nobody having the absolute. And he brought back into this Protestant-like church that he began the one element from Roman Catholicism that was missing, and that is absolutism. He now has created a church where one, like the Pope, can speak for God and tell you absolutely what you should do and how you should live your life. People are desperate for this in our changing world of high insecurity, and I think it is the superficial appearance of the Book of Mormon as evidence, okay, quote, evidence, unquote, for the revitalization of Christianity, and then the stepping in of the one element missing in Protestantism from Roman Catholicism. So one could say what he did, he created an Americanized, miniaturized, updated Roman Catholicism in Mormonism. We have the comparison to the Pope and the President, the Cardinals and the Apostles, and the priests, the bishops, and the Jesuits, as you know, that became the main focus in Christianity after Protestantism began and became so powerful in their education that every Catholic country booted the Jesuits out and finally forced the Pope to disband the Jesuits because of their power. They came back 40 years later. But I think we're talking a comparison with the professors at Brigham Young University. Okay. Now, let's see, somebody else had a hand up. Richard.
What do you think the implications for the future of the Mormon Church for if, in response to a naturalistic interpretation of the origins of the Book of Mormon? Otherwise, the Book of Mormon is not history, then what's going to happen?
Richard has asked, what are the implications for the Mormon Church if the Book of Mormon is not history? Trouble. Was it Grant Palmer last evening from the church education system who basically writes this book now? That basically the Book of Mormon and the origin of the stories in Mormonism are not valid. And people are left. We are left with what I mentioned earlier. People are really desperate for some degree of security, and that is why they will continue, I think. The leaders of the Mormon hierarchy are presenting, of course, a fabricated and censored history of Mormonism that is desired by people to try and find some degree of security. But I think the church is modifying, but the point there is that the church is modifying because of outside pressure. And without that outside pressure, some within, free thinkers within the church, and the outside pressures, I think this church, without that, including the government control, that this church would be really like Colorado City. And I think it is, hopefully, this encourages us to keep up the pressure to continue the modification, which will make the church hopefully more moderate, but at the same time more dissatisfying to people who want security. And of course, the reorganized church has taken that route, disbanding really belief in the historicity of the Book of Mormon and saying we need to believe in the values in the Book of Mormon, and has changed their name to the Community of Christ, but at the same time they are slipping as all of the Protestant churches who are not fundamentalist or evangelical are slipping. People are really frightened out there and want something they can grab hold of. Question, any other, how are we doing? I think we're done. And one more?
May I have to give Dan another chance to be more vague? I think he believes there are some differences between the theology in the Book of Mormon and the Campbellites, or what religion? Sidney Reagan.
Yeah.
Is it Don? Don has invited Dan to come up and make some further comments of the differences between the Disciples of Christ theology and the theology in the Book of Mormon.
Well, Campbell had, of course, he critiqued the Book of Mormon and didn't quite like it, but he and Sidney Reagan parted over several doctrines. One was the kind of millennium that should come, whether it was, Campbell was mostly post-millennialist, while Rigdon became a pre-millennialist, and Sidney Rigdon believed in the restoration of gifts, but Campbell did not. Campbell was kind of what you would call an anti-revivalist in a way. He thought they were just too emotional. And Sidney Rigdon, Campbell resisted also communal groups. He didn't believe in founding an economic system. And Sidney Rigdon, I don't know if he did or didn't, but some of his followers did, you know, the Isaac Morley and those guys, and their communal group started disintegrating. And then when Joseph got to Ohio, he gave a revelation that more or less was a compromise between the type of communal group. It was kind of a mixture of communism and capitalism in a way. And so there was Joseph had a different take on what communalism was to some of Sidney Rigdon's followers. I don't know if that answers it, but Sidney Rigdon's the bottom line is Sidney Rigdon wasn't the only one from whom Joseph Smith could get these ideas, and the implication is therefore it's because Sidney Rigdon believed this. It's kind of a post hoc fallacy in a way. If Sidney Rigdon believed this before Joseph Smith, therefore Joseph Smith got it from Sidney Rigdon, even if they didn't know each other. So I think you're into a logical fallacy there. But that's what my book, Religious Seekers, was all about, was to show how prevalent these ideas were, and that Joseph Smith's own family, Jason Mack, Lucy Mack Smith's brother, was a seeker and already believed these things before Joseph and Sidney Rigdon could ever know each other. So it was unnecessary.
Let me make a... I don't know if Sunstone or anybody's going to allow this to be published, but what I can do, if you're on the internet, come up and give me your email address up here. I can give you mine up here, and you can copy it down and then email me, and I can email you a copy of it. The paper is, the footnotes, I think, are among the most interesting. Of course, I didn't go into the footnotes. But so those who want the paper can get it through the internet. Thank you.
Down all your to whom? Then.